in our Christmas series. We're calling it Christmas Through LifePoint this year, and it's a little different. We've typically did Christmas at LifePoint. We this year are really challenging you to take Christmas to the community, and we're going Christmas through LifePoint, all right, which means Christmas through you to the people. So what we're doing is we're looking at it from a different angle and trying to help you see how God has done that all through history, all right? And if you're here today, I just want to tell you the passage that we're going to read today. I remember after the first service, people were like, I had no clue that stuff was in the Bible. And so I hope you today you learn some stuff, but when you're doing it, it's sort of like, I'm going to tell you what, I probably wouldn't even talk about this in church if it wasn't in the Bible, all right? Just know that. I'm going to give that disclaimer. Now you're going, oh my Lord, what's he going to talk about today? And so, but you know, if you know me, man, you know that if you come to my house and hang out with me, then you're going to feast on football if football's on. And football's on practically every day of the year now, from season. Praise the Lord. I love it. And I watch the most obscure game. Our staff talks, they make fun of me. I watch the most obscure football game because if it's football, I'm watching it. And I love it. And, you know, we love the Titans. And I say we means me and at my house. They've got to join in. But we love the Titans in my house, obviously. We live here in Middle Tennessee. And, man, we're huge Titan fans. But if you're a Titan fan, you know that you have to have an alternate team if you want to be excited during the playoffs, typically, right? During the postseason. And so I have some alternate teams. I have several teams that I like. One of those teams, probably my number one alternate team, would be the Seattle Seahawks. I love the Hawks. I'm going to tell you why, okay? So clap here and there. I love it for a couple of reasons. Number one, I love the city. Man, I've been to Seattle so many times. We planted a church there and started a church there, and I went there so many times, and it is just absolutely beautiful. It's evergreens. The climate is perfect year-round. I mean, I'm not a hot weather guy. I'm a cold weather guy. It doesn't get really cold there. I mean, it never gets as cold as it is here in the winter. It never gets as hot as it is here in the summer. It's beautiful. It's perfect. I love the city. But the second reason I love the Seahawks is because there's two players specifically on the team that we just absolutely love at my house. One of them is Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is the quarterback of the Seahawks, and he is one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. And he's one of these guys that, you know his story. He's short. NFL quarterbacks are typically tall. They need to see over their linemen, all that kind of stuff. So forever he's been like, man, you're not tall enough to be a quarterback. And he's like, well, I'll show you. And so he is one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL. But that's not why that he just draw because he's short. There's other short quarterbacks in the league that I just really don't like at all as far as football player. And so, but he, I love. Why? Because he loves Jesus. I mean, Russell Wilson loves Jesus. He's married to the recording artist Sierra, and if you know her, she's a pretty big pop artist, right? And so she and he, when they were dating, he was very public about his commitment to remaining sexually pure until he was married, that they were not going to have sex until he was married. Now, folks, this is a high-profile couple, and, man, to have that commitment and then to go public with that, you're inviting scrutiny from our world, right? And he was like, but he did that. He said that. You got to love a guy, man, who is one of the greatest quarterbacks in the NFL, who is committed to his faith and to the Word of God and living the Word of God. And so, man, it's like, when I know that, it's like I'm pulling for that dude, right? And I'm pulling for his team. But there's another guy on the Seahawks that just absolutely draw us to the Seahawks. And his name is Shaquem Griffin. Now, his brother, Shaquille, also plays for the Seahawks. He's one of the DBs. But Shaquem is not the one you hear of all the time from a football perspective. He's not a starter. He plays special teams mostly, which is important in the NFL. He's not won any games like Russell Wilson has for the Seahawks. He hadn't even really made a lot of big plays, but we love him because he is the very first one-arm player in the NFL. He only has one arm. And man, we love his story because he had to have his arm amputated when he was a boy because of a congenital birth defect. And so he's got one arm, but he is a beast on the football field. And man, he had a great college career. And when he was drafted, I'll never forget, when he was drafted, he was so excited because he said, man, I'm so excited because I will now be known as Shaquem Griffin, the football player, not Shaquem Griffin, the one-arm wonder, right? And you got to love that, right? Especially when you've got a son like me with one arm, who now you can got a son, and he's got like, look, you love to be able to point somebody and say, look, son, see that guy? He overcame. You can overcome. No matter what, you can overcome. You can be victorious, right? You can conquer. And so you got to love that. And so we pull for the Seahawks, right? Here's why I told you all this. Man, when you know the backstory of players like this, you can't help but pull for them and want them to do well, right? I mean, it adds layers and it adds just complex. It's just great. And, you know, they do all these human interest stories. And, you know, I just love football typically, but Amy, man, I mean, she knows something about that kid's mama that she's like, oh, I love that guy, right? Because she knows something about his backstory. Backstories are important. That's what we're doing in this Christmas series, right? We're looking at the backstory. We're going through the genealogy. I called it the forgotten Christmas passage last week because most people skip the genealogy in Matthew 1. It's 17 verses. It's a list of hard to pronounce names. And most people are like, man, you know, let's get through this and get to the important stuff. The birth of Jesus starts in verse 18. Let's just get there. So most people skip over it. But here's what I want you to know. We're going through the genealogy because it tells us so much of the backstory. And I believe that if you know the backstory, you can more fully appreciate the Christmas story. And I hope that's what's going to happen to you this year as we look at some of the backstory of some of these characters that are listed in Matthew. You read them, and somehow sometimes we don't connect them to what's going on. So we're doing that, all right? Last week we looked at Abraham, how the backstory of Abraham, how God brought Christmas through Abraham. 2,000 years BC. 2,000 years before Christ, Abraham, excuse me, I'm probably going to do a little coughing today just to warn you because I've got a little something going on. But so 2,000 years before Christ, God chose Abraham. He found Abraham. He said, Abraham, through you, I'm going to bring, you know, you're going to bless all the world, all the nations of the world. And he brought Christmas through Abraham as Jesus, you know, would come through the Jews. Abraham was the father of the Jewish nation and all that stuff. Today, we're going to look at the backstory by looking at a woman named Tamar. Okay, and I'm not going to read the entire genealogy today. I read that last week. Go back last week and watch online and look at Abraham so that you can follow along with these stories. But I'm going to read the first three verses till we get to Tamar. It says, "The book of genealogy of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Talked about Abraham last week. Abraham was the father of Isaac. And Isaac, the father of Jacob. Now, and Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Okay, now he says Judah and his brothers. The brothers happen to be the 12 brothers who become the 12 tribes of Israel. All right, and so Judah is the son of Jacob. Jacob, his name's changed to Israel, who the namesake of the nation, right? And so hopefully you're seeing the progression here of what God promised Abraham came true, as God's promises always do, right? And so, and his brothers, and Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, by Tamar, which is, this is the story that's steamy, and Perez, the father of Hezron, and Hezron, the father of Ram. So let me stop there, and we're going to dive into this. And genealogies, by the way, you're thinking, why is the genealogies even? Genealogies were important to the Jews. They were huge on genealogies for a couple reasons. Number one, the genealogy proved inheritance. Right? It proved inheritance. Number two, it proved that you were in the line of succession to the throne, right? I mean, the king that was a succession, the firstborn of the king, and if he was dead, it would go to the next heir to the throne. And that, so genealogies were important to succession and to the line of the heir of the throne. And so the Messiah, there were a lot of people who claimed to be the Messiah back during the day, first century, right? I mean, there were false messiahs everywhere. One of the ways that they would immediately go to say, is this guy's claim to be the Messiah even in the ballpark? Let's go to the genealogy. Is he from the line of Judah? If he's not from the line of Judah, he's not the genealogy. He's not the Messiah, because the scripture's clear. He's coming from not just Israel, but from the tribe of Judah, okay? And so it's not surprising then that Matthew starts with the genealogy. He's proving that Jesus indeed is traced back to the tribe of Judah. But so it's not surprising he talks about the genealogy, but who he mentions in the genealogy is really surprising. Right? Why? Well, again, a couple of reasons. One, typically when histories were written in that day, they were written by pro-historians who were hired by a rich man or a king to write his history, and he would make sure he wrote the history as he wanted it to be told. Really not a lot different than today's history. Might be some history teachers in here. Well, here's what history, there's always revisions and always new books. Why? Because history has a little bit to do with the facts and a whole lot to do with what somebody thought of that story, right? Even today in history books. And so what we have here is what happened then in the first century. is you have rich men and kings who hired professional historians to write their history as they want it to be told. So in other words, you write my history, but here's what I want you to do. Don't talk about the bad stuff. You write about my successes, but leave out my failures. You talk about my good relatives, but leave out my drunk uncles. Let's not mention them, okay? All right, so let's make it a good story that builds my legacy and all this kind of stuff. And so that was what's happening. So Matthew comes in and he writes Jesus' genealogy, and it's surprising because this is not what Matthew did. He didn't talk about the pillars of moral virtue when he wrote this story, right? I mean, women were not important in genealogies in the first century. They didn't really even count, right? Because it came through the men. Well, Matthew wrote four women in the genealogy. He specifically names four women. And they're not just any women. They're shady women, so shady that they had the honor of being profiled in a book that was written not too long ago called The Bad Girls of the Bible. Some of you women will remember that book, right? And so these are shady women, to be quite honest. The first woman is a woman named Tamar. She's one of the great, 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 many times grandmothers of Jesus, all right? And her story is amazing. Now, I'm going to warn you, okay? It's a story of sex. It's a gritty story. It's a story of injustice, right? It is all that, but we're going to look at it because it is an amazing story of grace. It's an amazing story of grace. And so I want to go and I want to read her story, start reading. We're going to walk through her story. It is in Genesis chapter 38. And some of you are like, if you think, I'm not going to read the Bible, it's boring. After today, you might say, I'm going to read this book. It's got stuff in it. Like, wow, right? So I've warned you, all right? So here we go. Genesis, first book of the New Testament. We're going back to the first book of the Old Testament, first book of the Bible. Genesis chapter 38. Verses 6 to 11, and here's what it says. And Judah, we're going back to Judah, Jesus' genealogy. We mentioned Judah. And Judah took a wife for his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord. Get this. And the Lord put him to death. Then Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform the duty of a brother-in-law to her. Getting a little steamy. And raise up an offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, so whenever he went into his brother's wife, he would waste the semen on the ground so as to not give offspring to his brother. It was in the Bible. I didn't just talk about it, all right? And email the Lord, not me. And when he, and what he did, let me see, I lost my place. Should have lost it before I read that last verse, right? And so what he did was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and he put him to death also. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till Shelah, my son, grows up, for he feared that he would die like his brothers. So Tamar went and remained in her father's house. Now, one of the main characters in this story is Judah Jacobson, all right? That was his name, Judah Jacobson. Now, Jacobson was not legally his surname, but it really was his name because he was Jacob's son, right? He was Jacob's son. Jacob was the son of Isaac. Isaac, the son of Abraham. And so Abraham then, we talked about last week, was Judah's great-grandfather. You're beginning to see the succession take place. He was his great-grandfather, and he is one of the main characters in this story. And Jacob had 12 sons. Judah was one of those sons, and those sons would become the 12 tribes of Israel. And Judah was very important because this is the line, the tribe, that God chose for the Messiah to be traced back to. So this is very important, all right? Now, when you look at all these brothers, if you know anything about these brothers, and maybe you are not familiar with the stories of the Bible, maybe you're new to church and not read the Bible, man, we're so glad you're here. And as I said, after a day, you're gonna go, oh, cool, man, this Bible, I'm gonna read it, right? And so, because I didn't know what I had this stuff. And so these brothers were shady and sketchy, every one of them, including Judah, except one. And it wasn't Judah, it was a man named Joseph. Some of you will remember Joseph. Maybe if you've never read the Bible, you've heard of a play called Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat. Well, that's what we're talking about here, right? Joseph was daddy's favorite. Now, fathers, I want to give you a warning here. If you got multiple kids, do not play favorites. You're setting yourself up for some pain in life if you do, all right? It's wrong. Well, someone should have told good old Jacob this, because Jacob, one of the heroes of our faith, he played favorites. He loved Joseph more than the other brothers, and they knew it. Joseph was, unlike his brothers, they were sketchy. He had a lot, he had utmost character and utmost integrity, but he did love being daddy's favorite. Right? I mean, he sort of threw that in his brother's face a little bit. And as a young dude, you can understand that. And his dad got him this really flashy coat. It was a really flashy multicolored Armani coat, real expensive. He gave it to Joseph. His brothers hated him for all that. But then his brothers really hated him when Joseph said, "Hey, guys, I had a dream last night. Let me tell y'all this dream. Basically, y'all were bound down to me, and I'm ruling over you," right? And they were like, "Oh, I'm going to kill this kid. I hate him," right? And so one day they were away from home, and Joseph comes showing up. They see him coming from a distance, and they said, "Right now's our chance. We're going to kill him." So they grabbed him. They threw him into the pit. They were going to kill him. But one brother said, "Hey, hold on a minute. I got a better idea. We can make us a little cash off of this. We kill him. We'd be rid of him, but we don't make anything. Here comes a caravan going to Egypt. Let's sell him to the caravan. They'll take him to Egypt, sell him as a slave. We'll never see the dude again. We get a little money. We'll take his just amazing flashy Armani coat. We'll rip it to pieces, put it in blood, tell daddy he was mauled by a wild animal." Because you see, they didn't have DNA testing back then. They didn't know if it was his blood or a goat's blood, right? And so they liked it. We're going to make us a little money, right? So that's exactly what happened. And it's ruthless, isn't it? But here's the thing. It was all a part of God's plan. All a part of God's plan. God was in control of every bit of this. Remember that. Because Joseph later in Genesis will say, "Hey, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. God was in charge of this thing. So I'm here because God," it was all a part of God's plan to get Joseph to Egypt, where he would be the prime minister, the second in command of the entire land, to save his people and his family. Okay? And so it's an amazing story. And man, I would encourage you to just go read it. Genesis is an amazing story, right? And so the other, so when we're looking at this, if you're thinking, okay, God's going to trace the line of Jesus, the Messiah, back to one of the tribes, you're thinking, surely it'll be character and utmost integrity. I mean, he's a genuine Old Testament hero. These other guys are infamous, right? He's famous. I mean, they're sketchy. He's not sketchy. Surely it's Joseph, but God didn't choose Joseph. God chose Judah. Why? See, you and I would have probably chosen it different, but not God. Why? See, I think that's part of the story. I think that's part, that's the story of the gospel. I think you're beginning to see the story of gospel. This whole story is God's story of redemption, right? And so the other major character is a woman named Tamar. Now, Judah had three sons. One's name was one's name was Onan, and one's name was Shelah, okay? So was his oldest, firstborn. That was the heir to the throne, right? That was the firstborn was the heir to the throne. That was the dude that got two-thirds of the inheritance and all this kind of stuff. And so was his firstborn. So in that day, the dad was a part of choosing a wife. Well, he chose Tamar was the woman he chose to be married to his son Now, was an absolute immoral jerk. So bad that the scripture says God killed him. Now, that'll get your attention, won't it? When it says God killed you, now this is the first, God has rained down fire on Sodom and Gomorrah earlier, but now this is the first individual that says God took his life because he was so wicked. I mean, that says how, that he was, you can imagine how bad this dude was, right? And so when was gone, what happened was Judah went to Onan, the secondborn, and said, "Hey, it's your responsibility, it's your duty to go perform the duties of a brother-in-law to Tamar, your sister-in-law, and, you know, in other words, get to know her really good until she has a son," right? And so let me tell you what's going on here. In that day, here was the custom. It was called the Levirate marriage, all right? And what would happen was if a man died, he didn't have children, and he had a brother, then his brother's duty was, it was the custom, the brother's duty, was to get to know his sister-in-law really good until she had a son, okay? And that son would then be the legal son of his dead brother, given an heir to his dead brother, ensuring the line continued. And it was the Levirate marriage, and it ensured that the widow was cared for and that she was protected and cared for. This was the custom. Now, as I'm talking about that, I'm like, all you women are like, okay, think about if that was today, right? I mean, you're sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, I'm thinking about my brother-in-law and I just threw up in my mouth just a little bit, right? Some of you ladies, I mean, your brother-in-law. Now, it cuts both ways, I'm telling you, because I've got a brother. And if my brother was about to marry a woman that was genetically challenged, so to speak, I'm like, I'm killing him before the wedding, right? I mean, it cuts both ways. And so, but this was the custom in that day. And it ensured that the widow was taken care of, the heir was to the brother and all that kind of stuff. And so this was Onan's responsibility. But notice, Judah told Onan, he didn't say to marry her, he said, go and fulfill your duty. So in other words, he didn't really marry her, he just enjoyed getting to know her really good and everything. But in doing so, he made sure she did not get pregnant, right? He made sure she didn't have a son. Why? Because if she got pregnant, then the child would legally be the firstborn of the firstborn. His inheritance just got cut greatly, right? And so he said, man, I'm going to make sure this woman doesn't get pregnant. I'm enjoying getting to know her and all, but I'm going to make sure she doesn't get pregnant. And so the Lord took him too, right? And so this story, it's like, I mean, it's amazing. I didn't know stuff's in the Bible. It's pretty cool, really, right? And the Lord took him too. And then so Judah has one more son, and his name is Shelah. And he said, well, I got one more boy, but he said, she ain't getting near him. I mean, she's married, two of my boys, they're dead. She's 0 for 2, she's dangerous. She's not touching Shelah, right? And so he didn't want to tell her that because he would have been dishonorable for him to tell her that. And so what he did was he goes to her and he says, look, Shayla's young man, and he's not ready to be married yet. He's a young man, so do this. You go to your daddy's house, stay with him. When he's older, when Shayla's older, I'll send for you and we'll, you know, do the all that kind of stuff. And so, but his whole intention was, I'm forgetting her, right? Because it was his duty to take care of her. He should have brought her into his house. If he's going to wait on Shelah to get old enough, which, you know, she's probably, to be quite honest with you, a late teenager. Shelah, I don't know how old he is because this was the custom and the age at which they got married. She's just probably a late teenager, and it was his, it would have been his duty to bring her into his house, care for her himself until Shelah was ready. But he was like, man, I'm not doing this deal. I'm going to send her home. So he sent her home shamed, penniless, disgraced. He sent her home. Right? And she waits a few years and she finally realized, bro, I've been duped. Judah's not letting me marry Shelah. He's not doing that. He's not going to give her, my first husband, an heir. He's not going to do that. I've been duped. I've been forgotten. And so she begins to scheme and plot and take matters into her hands. And let's go to verse 12 through 18. Here's what it says. In the course of time, the wife of Judah, Shua's daughter, died. So Judah's wife died. And when Judah was comforted, when he was overcame his mourning, when he was through mourning, he went up to Timnah to his sheep shearers, and he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And when Tamar was told, your father-in-law was going up to Timnah to shear his sheep, she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, wrapping herself up, and sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown up and she had not been given to him in marriage. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute, for she had covered her face. He turned to her at the roadside and said, just like any good man that's in the genealogy, he turned to her and said, just like any good man in Jesus' genealogy, hey, I know you're a good woman, but you're a prostitute. Man, God still loves you. Let me share the gospel with you, buy you some water, take you in whatever, and then he went on down the road. Because that's what people in Jesus' genealogy did, right? Well, let's see. No, he turned to her on the roadside and said, come, let me come into you. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. She said, what will you give me that you may come into me? He said, oh, man, I'll give you a goat. That was the price of his prostitution. I'll give you a goat. He answered, I'll send you a goat from the flock. And she said, if you give me a pledge till you send it. He said, what pledge shall I give you? She replied, your signet and your cord and your staff that's in your hand. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. I mean, man, this is a really crazy story, isn't it? I mean, this right here. Did you think this stuff was in the Bible? I mean, and so what happens here is Tamar hears that her father-in-law, Judah, good old Judah, his wife died, and he's coming to town to have his sheep sheared. And this only happens so often, and so it was probably customary in that day. When you go to Timnah, I mean, you're gonna unwind a little bit. You know what I mean? I mean, what happens in Timnah stays in Timnah, right? Wrong. right? I mean, we're going to find that out. And so she knows he's coming to town, and here's what she does. She begins to plot and scheme how to seduce him. And she takes off her widow's garments, it says, and she puts on a little different clothing. In other words, here's what she does. She takes off her widow's garments. She puts on a high, tight little mini skirt, puts on some loud perfume, covers her face so he can't see who it is, and she knows exactly where he's going to pass by. And she goes out there, and man, I mean, she flaunts herself in front of him, and he sees her, and he's like, oh, my wife's dead? Okay. So he goes in and propositions her. Didn't know it was his daughter-in-law. She had her face covered. He propositions her. He says, hey, I'm interested in your services. And she said, what are you going to give me? He says, well, I got a goat. You want a goat? I mean, and you're thinking, a goat? God love her. In that day, that was a pretty good price, right? I mean, a goat was valuable in that day. And he said, I got a goat, but I don't have it with me, or I don't have to send it to you. Check's in the mail. She's, you know, he's like, oh, no. Listen, I'm going to need some collateral. What do you want? Well, I'll tell you what. I'll take your signet, your cord, and your staff. Now, what his signet was it was the ring that identified his authority and who he was. I mean, it was like when he sent a letter, I sealed it. So this was a signet around his neck. He would stamp it, you know, like you got a stamp, and his staff. Basically, these were the things that completely identified him. So let me put it in today's world. So he goes into the prostitute and he says, hey, look, I'm going to pay $100. I'll send you, but I don't have it with me. I'll send it to you. I'll cash app you later, right? It's like, oh, no. Until I get it, I'm going to need some collateral. Okay, well, here's my American Express and my driver's license. You keep them, right? I mean, you can tell he had one thing on his mind. Whatever you want, I'll give it to you, okay? But this was all part of her plan. So he gives her his American Express, his driver's license, and he goes in, and man, he gets to know his daughter-in-law at a whole new level, and she becomes pregnant. Okay, now let's pick up the story verse 24. In verse 24, it says, about 3 months later, Judah was told, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has been immoral. Moreover, she is pregnant by immorality. And Judah said, bring her out, let her burn. I mean, what did she think, having sex with somebody that's not her husband? Always been a sexual double standard, hadn't there? You see, Tamar is just using the sexual double standard. I mean, you know, he probably called her a name that you can think of that men call women that, you know, are loose and, I mean, you know, but not him, right? And so Judah said, bring her out and burn her. Now, I want you to understand that was, in that day, sex before marriage was a death penalty, right? I mean, but the death penalty was typically by stoning. So the fact that he said, burn her, this is a whole different level. He said, burn her, and as she was being brought out, she sent word to her father-in-law by the man to whom these belong, his signet, his cord, his staff, by the man to whom these belong. Hey, Judah, by the way, here's your American Express and your driver's license back, right? By the man to whom these belong, I'm pregnant. Bam! And she said, please identify whose they are, the signet, the cord, and the staff. Then Judah identified them and said, she is more righteous than I, since I did not give my son Shelah, and he did not know her again. Now, in the Bible, the word know means have sex. He knew her as Adam knew her, so he did not have sex with her again. And so here's what you have. So Judah, after he, you know, propositions his daughter-in-law without knowing his daughter-in-law, gets to know her really good, he goes home. He's thinking what stays in Timnah, what happens in Timnah stays in Timnah. It never does, guys and gals. Your sins will find you out, okay? And so 3 months later, when about the time she would begin to have a baby bump, right? He gets word that, hey, your daughter-in-law, you know, the one that was married to Ur, and then Onah, I mean, she's pregnant. She doesn't have a ring on her finger. And he's like, man, oh, that's horrible. She's been sleeping around. That's horrible. You bring her out and let's burn her. See, I think he was so cruel, not just wanting to stone her, but burn her, because I think that he still held her responsible for his two sons' deaths. She's married to Ur, he died. She's married to Onan, he died. And she's responsible, because it can't be Junior's fault. Doesn't that sound like parents today? It's not Junior's fault, it's the school's fault. It's not Junior's fault, it's the teacher's fault. It's the coach's fault. It's the friend's fault. It can't be my son's fault. You see, you see that a lot, don't we? And that's exactly what he thought back then. Hey, it's not my son's fault. It had to be her, rather than owning that they were wicked men, right? And so he held her responsible, and so he wanted her to burn, which tells he was cruel, and man, he was vengeful, and it just tells the level that he's going to burn her, right? So just as they're taking her to execution, they're taking her to be burned at the stake, well, she says, hold on just a second. She pulls out this, you know, his driver's license and his credit card, his signet and his staff. Give these to Judah. See if he can identify them, because these belong to my baby daddy. Right? And so he takes them, and Judah gets them, and Judah's like, they're mine. I remember. So he hangs his head in shame and says, she's more righteous than I. What she did wasn't righteous, was it? It wasn't a righteous act. But what she did was more right than what he had ever done, because she didn't honor him, but she was more interested in the line of Judah than even he was. I mean, I'm telling you, folks, when you look at this story, I love it. I'm just going to tell you, 6 months later, as we read in the genealogy, 6 months later, she had twins, Judah's twins. She had twins, and their names were Perez and Zerah. They're all mentioned there in the genealogy of Jesus. I love this story. Well, it's gritty. It's not a sanitized little baby in a manger Christmas story, all right? This is gritty, and this is messy, and I love it because, hey, you thought your family was messed up? I mean, man, this is a Jerry Springer show waiting to happen. My daddy is my granddaddy. He just hadn't done that one yet, but you'll see it, okay? I mean, you thought your family was messed up? Listen, I mean, man, this is one messed up, jacked up family, isn't it? Doesn't that give you hope? I mean, I love this. I mean, if you're going to mention a woman in the genealogy, which didn't happen then, you got all kind of women. I mean, there's generations and generations, and every person in genealogy born was born to a woman. So there's all kind of women. There had to be women of high moral virtue in the genealogy, but he didn't mention those. He mentioned Tamar. He mentioned Rahab, a prostitute. Talk about her next week. He mentioned Rahab, a prostitute. He mentioned Tamar here, who sleeps with her father-in-law. He mentions these women. Why? Why would he mention these women? Because they're the point of the gospel, I think. You see Tamar and Rahab and Bathsheba. Yeah, I mean, they're not accidents in the story of Christmas, in the story of Jesus. They're the point of the story of Jesus. They're what Christmas is all about, folks. They're what Christmas is all about. That's why I'm hoping knowing the backstory gives the Christmas story a whole new meaning, right? I mean, listen, what can we learn from this? This is a great story, and we just told the story. What can we learn from it, man? Let me give you some things that you can really, I hope, take to heart and that changes your life and your perspective and your mind about God and about you, right? First off, here's what we can learn. In that day, you know how people was... how people approached God and how people were made right with God. In our mind, they did it through effort, through work, through what they did, right? I mean, what I do and what I don't do. If I do enough good, man, God will love me and think I'm good enough to be a part of his Super Bowl team. But, you know, if I don't do good enough, then God's going to cut me. You know, I'm not going to make the team. God's going to look at me and say, that's a karmic view of life, isn't it? It's about karma. You hear people talk about karma all the time. Well, I mean, man, do good to you and it'll come back to you. Woo! You know, I mean, all that kind of stuff. That's the karma view of life, right? But people apply that to God because it has to be. That's how we earn stuff. We earn promotions. We earn raises. We earn daddy's praise, most of us. And so we just transition that over to God, and we say, man, I got to get to God. And all my life is spent working to get to God. I want to make God happy. It's what I do. It's what I don't do. It's my work. It's my effort. And you know what? Jesus comes in, and he flips the script. And he's shown us all along, he's dropped these crumbs all through the story of redemption. He's dropped these crumbs that says, look at Tamar, it's not about what you do and don't do. David, he committed adultery and then killed the woman's husband so he could have her. It's not about what you do and don't do. I think David would have been cut at that point, right? Jesus flips the script, said, I've dropped these crumbs, but you haven't gotten it. I didn't give you the law so you'd keep it and be saved. I gave you the law so you could look at it and say, there's no way I can do this. I'm doomed. Bam, you're right. So he gave us these crumbs to say, it's not what you do. He flipped the script, and here's the story of Christmas and the backstory. It's all over the backstory. The story of Christmas is you don't work your way to God. You can't work your way to God. You don't have to work your way to God. The story of Christmas is God came to you. God came to you. The story of Christmas is you can't do enough. It's not about what you do. It's about what Jesus did for you. That's the story of Christmas. And so here's the beautiful thing. Some of you today watching and some of you today in this room are still trying to get your act together and get your life together so God will accept you. You've got to be good enough. I want you to look at Tamar. I want you to look at Judah, who sold his brother as a slave and then had sex with his daughter-in-law, and he was both his son's granddaddy and daddy. I mean, I want you to look at David, who committed murder after he committed adultery, and I want you to understand you will never get your life and your act together. You can't. But you don't have to, because Jesus did it for me. You got to stop trying and start trusting. That's the beautiful story of Christmas. It's not about trying, it's about trusting. Then that changes everything, right? Beautiful, man. I love this story because it's good for people like me that can't be good enough. So that's one thing. You'll never get your life together. You don't have to get your life together. You can't get your life together. It's not about what you do. It's about what Jesus did. Do you trust him? Do you trust him? See, here's what I also love about this. Have you ever made a lot of stupid mistakes in your life? Have you? Anybody made stupid mistakes? Well, I'm just going to say I have. Yeah, you can raise your hand because, listen, those that raise your hand, everybody else needs to. I've made a lot of stupid mistakes. I'm just going to call them out there. I've committed a lot of stupid sins, okay? I mean, there ain't a sin that's not stupid, but I've committed a lot of stupid ones, okay? I mean, I've committed a lot of mistakes and stupid sins. And you know what some of you are doing right now? I mean, some of you, you still haven't let go of it. You still haven't. I mean, as a believer in Jesus Christ, some of you are believers in Jesus Christ. If you're not a believer in Jesus Christ, I completely understand. I completely understand you hanging on to it because you don't have anywhere to take it. Oh, counseling can tell you can do this with it, but you can't. And it's still hanging over your head and it's still just on you like a spider monkey, man. And it's all over you. Right? And you can't ever get rid of it. And if you don't know Christ, I understand. But you see, for those of you who know Christ, man, you dropped that somewhere. You see, you didn't drop it. Let me go back. Remember my first part. Somebody took that from you. It was Jesus. When he died on the cross, it said that stupid sin that you committed, it was on Jesus on the cross. That's the story of Christmas. And so here's the whole point of that. I've committed a lot of stupid sins, a lot of crazy mistakes. I've done stuff that I said, Pat, You know when Paul said it's what I don't do that I want to do and what I don't do. You remember when Paul, he's like, he felt the same way as you, man. He's like, why do I keep doing this stupid stuff, right? But some of you have done some stuff, whether it was an unfaithful moment to your spouse, whether it's you walked out on somebody, whether it was, I mean, I don't know, you name it. I can come up with all kinds of stuff, but it's all over this room. And you're still dragging it around and it's still affecting your life. You know what the story of Christmas tells, the backstory, all the backstory? It says this. It says that God is bigger than any mistake, any failure, any sin you've ever committed. God's grace is bigger. Did you know that? God's grace is bigger. I mean, Tamar and Judah, man, they were both a mess and did some sketchy things, as did all the brothers of the 12 tribes of Israel, as did all the disciples, as did David, as did all the great heroes of our faith. They did messed up things, but God redeemed their broken mess. And Perez became the firstborn of the firstborn. The line was continued. See, what Tamar, what Judah, what you would look at and go, whoa, gosh, that's sinfully wicked. God just redeemed that and said, that's the firstborn of the firstborn. I'm using that. Folks, there's no sin you've committed. There's nothing you've done that God cannot redeem and use for your good and his glory. Nothing. Drop it. If you are a believer, guess what? Jesus has taken those sins from you. There is therefore now no condemnation for those who are in Jesus Christ. If you believe that, quit going back and hanging on to the stuff that's preventing you from seeing your future with freedom. Let it go. God has taken it from you. Don't let the enemy hold you back. Do not reduce God to the size of your biggest sin. God's bigger than that. That's the story of Christmas. I'm sorry, I'm gonna start preaching in a minute. That's the story of Christmas. That's the story of Christmas. That's why when we meet with addicts, and we were talking with, you know, Adam, who's one of our guys who runs our addiction, we don't tell addicts, as some of you heard, "Hi, my name's Pat, I'm an addict." We don't tell them that. Not if they're redeemed by Jesus, because they're not. That doesn't define you any longer. Jesus does, right? It's new. So, do not reduce Jesus to your stupid, okay? That's just what I call sin, stupid. I'll rename it stupid, right? I mean, I commit them, I'm stupid, Pat. Don't reduce Jesus to your stupid. He's bigger. His grace is bigger than our stupid, all our crazy and all our stupid. His grace is bigger, and he's forgiven you. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, be free from it. Move forward. Listen, if you're not, there's only one way you can truly be free of it. Either you will carry that around the rest of your life, or you can let Jesus take it from you. Man, I suggest letting Jesus take it from you. Let him take it from you. Give your life to him today. There's nothing that you've ever done, nothing that you've ever done that disqualifies you. Nothing that you've ever done where God says, "I'm cutting you from my team." There's nothing you can do to make God love you more, and there's nothing you can do to make God love you less. If you're his child, you've got to get that truth in your brain. It's a whole new way of living. And then finally, man, you know what I love about this? When I was reading this week and I was studying this week, and some commentators, some people I was reading, that they pointed out this, and it was just so beautiful for me. The first two are beautiful for me too. I talked about how, I mean, man, you know, you can't work your way to God because we're all there at the time. I mean, about, you know, God's not reduced to the size of your biggest mistake. Man, we all need to hear that. But let me tell you something. Here's what I want you to say. We can learn that your family of origin is not an accident. Let me tell you why that's important. Because some of us, man, your family of origin has not been great for you. I mean, man, it's not been great. It's been hell, to be honest, right? I mean, your dad, I mean, man, your relationship with your dad, some of you, I mean, it's just been heck. I mean, it's been horrible. The thing, your dad's never praised you. Your dad's never given you encouragement. Your mom left you. I mean, man, your family of origin is one jacked up mess, and you're thinking, "I'm a product of that, and I'm gonna continue that, and I'm just jacked up because of it. God, why did you let me be born to this?" I mean, you've all thought about that stuff, right? If I'd had a daddy like that, if I'd had a mama like that, let me make sure you understand something, that your family of origin was by design. You were not born to the parents, or you were not adopted into the family. However you got into your family, you are not there by accident. You are not there by the luck of the draw. You're not there by happenstance or chance. You're in your family by the hand of God. And you say, "Well, how would God do that?" Listen, you're seeing about that much. You're seeing about that much, right? God can take that, and this is what I spent 3 months studying this summer on sabbatical, okay? So I know a little bit about this. God, I spent 3 months studying this, and here's what I know, man. God will use your family of origin to mold you and to shape you if you will allow him and surrender to his will. He will mold you and shape you into the man or the woman of God that he wants to use those things for his glory and your good, and they're not wasted, and they're not absolutely just crazy. They are there for a purpose. Think about poor old Perez. Man, I mean, this guy was born in, his daddy was his granddaddy. That's some baggage, isn't it? I mean, that's some baggage. He's going through life, his daddy is his granddaddy. I mean, he's got a single mom, right? I mean, he's got some baggage. And Perez, at that thing, just think, man, I'm my mama, my daddy's my granddaddy, and my mama's single. What in the world? He might have even died thinking, "What has my life mattered?" Now, you let me ask you today, what does his life matter? The firstborn of the firstborn. You can't even tell in your life what kind of impact you're going to have. That's what this tells. You've got to go and look generations and say, "Wow, Perez's life had a huge impact on the world." So will yours if you are a child of God, he will take and he will mold and everything of your family and origin. And you say, what if I become like that? Let me make sure you understand. You are not your parents and your parents are not you, and you don't have to make the same mistakes they made. It can be broken with you. It can be broken with you. God can take it and mold it and use it, and your life might have been a mess and your family might have been a mess, but you know what mess is? M-E-S-S. It's the first four letters of message. God can take your mess and turn it into a message that changes the world. That's what I love about this story. That's what you should love about this story. It's full of grace. It's gritty. It's messy. It's not sanitized, but it's grace, and we all need it. We all need it. Let's pray together, can we? Father, we love you. Thank you for your amazing grace. We see it all over this story. God, we look at this. I'm so thankful for the backstory. God, I'm thankful that you, Lord, that none of the 12 tribes of Israel, none of those sons were perfect. I thank you that Tamar wasn't perfect. I thank you that Ruth wasn't perfect. I thank you that Samuel wasn't perfect. I thank you that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was not born of a virgin and was not perfect. I thank you that she had flaws and sins, and God, for how you used her. God, what a story of grace that is for me. God, that's so much hope for a man like me. God, I often wonder, how in the world did you choose me? Where I'm from, how did you choose me? And God, over and over you said, Pat, it's by my grace. And I praise you and worship you for your grace. That's the story of Christmas. I pray today that you would let these people in this room, watching online, all over the world, understand your grace at a whole nother level, God. We love you and thank you for grace. And thank you for Christmas revealing your grace. In Jesus' name, amen. Right now, some of you need Jesus. Man, this story of grace, our ushers are going to take up offering. And go ahead, guys, take up offering. Put your offering in there. Put your cards in there. But let me tell you something. Some of you need grace. You need Jesus. You'll hang on to this stuff all of your life if you don't have Jesus, because you have nowhere to really give it. But Jesus wants to take it from you. Will you let him today? Listen, some of you today, you've heard some stuff about your family. It's caused you to go back, and it's pulled a scab off of an old wound, and you're going, man, I want to give you hope today. I didn't do that. I want to give you hope that your parents are not you. You're not your parents. You don't have to do that. God will use that and mold you and make you if you will allow him. Will you let him do that today? Now, we're saying, God, as we looked at how God brought Christmas through Abraham and Tamar, we're challenging you to let God take Christmas through you, Christian, to our community, to your one. First off, to your one. How are you taking Christmas to your one? Let me tell you a little story this week that happened last week. We've asked you, you see these boards up, and they've got a sticker with a name on it. And that name is the one of people. Who's your one? Who's the one person? Man, we want the world to be saved, but who's the one person that you're really praying for, investing in, asking God to save? Well, one woman at one of our campuses, she put the name of her husband on that one. That's a good one, by the way. If your husband is not a believer, or your wife, or your child, that should be your one, right? And so she put the name of her husband on her one. And she didn't just put his first name. She put his first and last name. Now, we've said, hey, look, you might just want to put their first name, right? Because if you put their last name, they see it. Well, I mean, it'll open up a conversation for you, I bet. Yeah, that could be good. But she put his first name and his last name. And he came to church, and he was me, and it wasn't one of our pastors. I want you to understand this. It wasn't one of our pastors. It was one of the leaders at this campus, shared the gospel with her husband. He surrendered to Jesus, gave his life to Christ. She walked out, went to that board, found her husband's name, marked through it, and put answered on there. Isn't that awesome? That's beautiful, isn't it? Who's your one? How are you going to take Christmas to your one? You can't save them, but man, what are you doing? How are you going to take Christmas to your one? Invite them to church. That's what she was doing to her husband. Invite them to church. You got two more opportunities at Christmas, and most people will come if they're invited. You got two more Sundays, then Christmas Eve. Don't forget Christmas Eve, right? Christmas Eve candlelight service, beautiful, amazing. Invite the community. Who's your one? Invite them, right? And so now, that's your one, but how are you going to take Christmas to your community? Listen, go to your app. I'm going to go to my phone here, and if you've got your app, go to it sometime, but I'm going to go to my phone. And by the way, if you've got an app, when you open your app, you have to hit that refresh button down here, and it'll refresh because we update. And then if Christmas Through Life Point, and if you click on that, man, it's got all kind of opportunities for you to take Christmas to our community, Christmas through you to our community. For instance, man, if you go down, the first thing you see is Feed the Hungry. Our mayor and our councilman here in our city has asked us to get involved in a push to stock the Nourish Food Bank. We got a lot of people in our community that need the Nourish Food Bank. We're the church. They've asked us to get involved. And here's what we're doing. We're asking you to bring, if you'll look on your app, it'll tell you instant potatoes, canned beans, corn, all these kind of things. Man, bring them. We've got boxes set up at the Go Centers. You take, bring some of these things for the next 2 weeks. Bring it. Let's make sure that people who need food have got food. All right? So please bring some. But now here's what I want to say. I've challenged you to bring it, and please do. But let me go over here and say this. We live in a generation of people growing up, not to pinhole anybody in that, who think, man, if I'm going to buy me a pair of Tom's shoes because somebody in Africa will get a pair of Tom's shoes, I've done my job. Okay? But bringing a canned food, just so you know, you should do, because that helps people don't have it. But that does not absolve you and say, oh, I did my part. No, that's not even JV. Okay? That's not even JV for people in this room. Right? We all ought to do this. So you bring the canned food. You bring the non-perishable items. But then how are you going to get involved in serving? Where are you going to put feet and hands to that? Okay? And so there's all kind of ways. If you'll go to your app, you're going to see, if you thumb on down, you're going to see, man, Operation Saving a Life. We talked about a story today about a woman who literally fought to have a son. She fought to have a son. All kind of people in our world today fight to not have them. We partnered with a ministry called Operation Save a Life that goes, and they really, you know, with our mobile ultrasound that we're helping provide, and we partnered with them. That's a good way for you to get involved and fight for children. Fight for children. You can get involved by the Shepherd's Closet. I'm just highlighting a few that pertain to the message today. The Shepherd's Closet. It's a closet that one of our LifePoint ladies runs that is a foster care. And when people get a foster child, they might not have immediately, they're calling me a lot. They might have formula, might not have a high chair, they might not have a car seat. Well, we got a lady, a LifePoint lady, that runs a ministry that's called the Shepherd's Closet. They call her and she opens it up, brings them in, they get diapers, they get whatever they need for that child. You can get involved in that. Maybe you get involved in prison ministry. Women and men, we got ministry. Maybe get involved in S2L. It's our addiction program, you know, that we work with. I say ours. We partner with S2L, Spring to Life, which is the leader of the ministry is a life pointer. All right. So many ways to get involved. How will you let Christmas go through you to our community? Bring the food, but get involved. Okay, bring the food, we get involved. Let's all stand. Travis is going to lead us. If you don't know Jesus, and today you want somebody to take some of this stuff from you, you come and talk to us. We'd be glad. We'd love to talk to you, right? You pray about during this time, how will I get involved and let God take Christmas through me to the community?